I want to thank our listeners for joining us. Remind everyone that Food Sleuth Radio is produced by Dan Hemmelgarn for KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. But most of all, I want to thank my guest, Ms. Marianne Lanzettel. You can learn more about her work at www.londoncowgirl.com and watch for her new book, Sustainable Meat Production and Processing, Local, Profitable, and Humane. Thank you so much for sharing your time with me today, Marianne.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
And you're tuned to WBAI New York, WBAI.org online. Coming up next at 3 p.m. is the Black Star News on WBAI, hosted by Milton Alimadis. Stay tuned.
Yes, welcome, welcome, sisters and brothers. Welcome to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM New York Radio, also streaming on WBAI.org. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi, joined as always by my comrade and friend, managing editor of Black Star News, Colin Benjamin.
Good afternoon, brother. How are you doing today?
I am good. It's good to be back. Listeners, as you know, WBAI has been doing a fund drive, so that's why you didn't hear from us for the last 2 weeks. And we ask you to support WBAI's fund drive because, as you know, WBAI is 100% listener-supported station, and that is why we have the luxury to discuss any topic and any issue we want. So, comrade Colin Benjamin, I know you wanted to recall an event before we get into today's discussion.
Yeah, we just wanted to acknowledge the people in Buffalo.
Yes,
today,
of course.
Today is the second anniversary of that horrible event that took the life.
Yes, the horrific massacre, of course, of innocent people who were just shopping.
And I should also say that, you know, this is happening at a time when, you know, we have these reports now telling us again that Black people are still at the top of the target list, if you will. You know, in these recent weeks, we have been hearing a lot of pretenders in Congress who pretend to care about certain hate crimes, but somehow certain other hate crimes they don't seem to care about at all.
Right. They're very selective in their outrage. Absolutely.
But, I was just going to say again, you know, we wanted people in Buffalo to know that, you know, we're thinking of them and their family today.
Absolutely. And we're going to make that the Buffalo massacre a topic of one of our upcoming shows. All right. So I'd like to ask to welcome our guest for today's show, but I want to read her bio first, briefly, and whatever we leave out, we will fill in as the discussion and conversation proceeds today. Laura Trevelyan is a journalist and advocate who was an anchor and correspondent for BBC News. She's an honorary associate fellow at the P.J. Patterson Institute. And of course, listeners, you are familiar with PJ Patterson, the former Prime Minister of Jamaica. PJ Patterson Institute for Africa, Caribbean Advocacy at the University of West Indies, and a trustee of the Trevelyan Grenada Reparations Fund. Laura left BBC News in March 2023 after a 30-year career, following her family's historic trip to Grenada in February 2023, where she led the Trevelyan's public apology to the Grenadian people for the role of their ancestors in enslaving Africans on the island. Laura is a co-founder of Heirs of Slavery, a group of British people whose ancestors profited from the enslavement of Africans in the Caribbean. Heirs of Slavery is encouraging other families with similar histories to acknowledge this fraught past and calling on Britain's government to engage in reparatory justice talks with Caribbean governments. Laura Trevelyan, welcome to Black Star News Show.
Thank you so much, Milton and Colin. So nice to meet you both.
Excellent. We're delighted to have you. Okay, so let's get straight into it. So you are a descendant of the Trevelyan family that at one point enslaved about 1,000 Africans on 6 plantations in Grenada. Now, there's a very interesting aspect that many of our listeners may not be aware of, which is that after slavery was abolished by Britain, the British Parliament approved compensation to the former enslavers who were now to lose their property. And that came at that time, the amount was 20 million pounds. And I was doing some research and I'm looking at different numbers. But then I went somewhere and I found a estimate that one British pound in 1835 has the purchasing power today of 160. So that would bring the amount to roughly $5 billion US dollars, I believe. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that amount to put things in perspective. But you are the founder of Heirs of Slavery. I would like to ask you, what was the main impetus for founding this organization? What were some of your expectations? And have some of those expectations been met? And which are the ones that have not yet been met?
Well, Milton, that's a lot of questions, and I will try not to talk for too long. But just to start with that figure that you quoted, I mean, there are different ways of how you calculate inflation. But the fact is that in 1834, when slavery was abolished, 20 million pounds to pay off the enslavers, because there was a very powerful lobby in Parliament at that time called the West India Lobby. And essentially, yes, without placating that lobby, slavery would not have been abolished. And the tragedy of it is that during the abolitionist debates in Parliament, several abolitionists said, should we not be paying compensation to the enslaved, those who have lost their liberty, those who have not had the right to education or own land? But it was, such were the politics of the time, that it was the enslavers who were paid off, because that was the only way to get abolition through. And actually, it took Britain's government until 2015 to pay off that loan. Such was the size of it, if you can imagine. So when people talk about reparations and taxation and how general taxation shouldn't be used for reparations, the fact is that Britain's taxpayers from 1834 until 2015, and of course, Britain's society diversified massively in that time, so that by the end, you had indeed descendants of the enslaved in the Windrush generation who had moved to Britain, whose taxes were going towards paying off that loan that was taken out to pay off the enslavers. So I like to use that as an example when people say, well, you can't use taxation for reparations, it's not fair. There are many unfairnesses in general taxation, of which that is just one. But thank you for your question about Heirs of Slavery, Milton. And there, Alex Renton, who's a British campaigning journalist, wrote a book called Blood Legacy, a couple of years ago about how he's descended from enslavers in the British Caribbean. And at the end of his book, Alex raises the question, is there a role for the heirs of slavery? And by that, he means those people whose ancestors profited from slavery and those people who today may not have the wealth of their ancestors, but enjoy a privileged social position because of this history. Is there a role for them in trying to get others to acknowledge this past and the legacies of today? So that was the purpose of the group. Alex Renton and I were the co-founders, with seven of us in total with this background. And after I left the BBC in March of last year, after our family had gone to Grenada and we'd worked with Grenadian leaders on our apology and reparation strategy, it just seemed like there was so much more to be done. So many people got in touch with me saying, I have this background, what do I do? So Heirs of Slavery was a way of just, in a way, creating an inbox for these people. But more than 150 people, honestly, from around the world, including here in the United States, where we're talking today, but also as far afield as New Zealand and France, such were the tentacles of the transatlantic slave trade. People have got in touch essentially saying, how do I acknowledge this past? What do I do? But the very specific remit, in a way, of Heirs of Slavery was to call on Britain's government to engage in talks with CARICOM, that's the Intergovernmental Association in the British Caribbean, on the basis of its 10-point plan for reparations, which has existed since 2014. So that was the purpose of it. You say, what's been achieved? Well, the current Conservative government in Britain has absolutely no interest at all in discussing reparations or apologising for Britain's historic role in the slave trade. But it's likely that there could be a change in government in Britain later this year. The King of England has said that he is deepening his understanding of the legacies of slavery. He's a constitutional monarch, so he can't go too far ahead of the government of the day. But maybe if there's a change in government, if the new Labour Foreign Secretary is David Lammy, who's a Guyanese-British child of the Caribbean, maybe more things will be possible than they are at the moment, Milton.
Okay, very good. So let me just have a follow-up question there then. You mentioned the issue of taxation for reparations. You are definitely soon probably going to have some Republicans protesting outside your house, so we are not going to disclose where you live. And you show a little bit of optimism that perhaps under a Labour administration, these issues could have a different reception. But even going beyond that, what have you seen any change in public perception, public attitude toward reparations in the United Kingdom? And then finally, before I get my colleague Colin involved, what about in the United States? You've lived here for many years, so what has been your observations? Well, go ahead.
Yeah, well, these are great questions. I mean, in terms of Britain, there's very little public opinion polling that's really been done on the subject of reparatory justice. But some was done recently, which I hope will provide a baseline. And it was done by the Repair Campaign, which is funded by Dennis O'Brien, the chairman of Digicel, the phone network, which is so prevalent across the Caribbean. And Dennis, having worked in the Caribbean for many years, wanted to try to give back. And so the Repair Campaign is amplifying CARICOM's reparatory justice plan, that 10-point plan that begins with an apology and asks the former colonial powers to invest in healthcare, education, and also to forgive the Caribbean's enormous load of debt. So that reparations ask is very different from that in the United States. It's very different from 40 acres and a mule, if we go back to the beginning. CARICOM's is not about cash descendants for individuals. It's about cash descendants for the islands, in a way, I guess, because if you think of somewhere like Grenada, where my ancestors were enslavers, it's kind of 115,000 people live there. Right. It's not a very big island. Pretty much everybody is a descendant of an enslaved African. So investment in healthcare and education will benefit the entire community. So that's one way, I guess, in which the reparations debate is different. But do I think that a Labour government would pay reparations to the Caribbean? Not necessarily, but I think that they could take the existential threat of climate change, which the Caribbean islands are grappling with now. They could take that more seriously, invest in climate resiliency. I think a Labour government could apologise for slavery, and that would open the door for the King. But you ask Milton about the situation here in the United States, and quite a few people got in touch have got reached out to me who are Americans, saying, is there a similar organization in the US? There is Coming to the Table. I don't know if you're aware of that, which that comes from a Martin Luther King saying, one of his many prophetic ones, the idea that one day descendants of the enslaved would sit down with descendants of the enslavers to talk about these legacies. So that's what Coming to the Table does. It's maybe a bit less campaigning in its ambitions than perhaps Heirs of Slavery is, and it's more about dialogue rather than calling on governments to act. But, you know, the situation in the US, well, it's very, I want you and Colin to tell me what you think, because you're the experts. But having lived here for many years, it's just really, it's very difficult and painful to see that so many African Americans still are more likely to live in poverty, are more likely to have bad housing, more likely proportionately to become embroiled in the criminal justice system, are less likely to have the benefits of others. And this is just, it's so hard. And the question is, what do you do about it? I mean, how do you build public support? And I see that California's Reparations Commission didn't really seem to build that much public support with its work. And I sincerely hope that here in New York, the newly formed commission will learn from California and make sure that what it does is communicated properly and can build public support.
Colin?
Mm-hmm. Well, to just touch on that, before I ask my questions, to just touch on the last part that Ms. Trevelyan was talking about, I think we need people like you in particular, more people like you, because, you know, we know that African-American population percentage-wise is only 12 to 30%. So, you know, in terms of getting a lot of white people to kind of understand, you know, the whole reparations questions, we need people like you and what you're doing. But my first question is, in reading several things about you and looking at several things online about you, you reference Professor Sir Hilary Beckles of the University of the West Indies a lot, and the Caribbean Community Reparations Commission. Talk a bit about, you know, how you met Professor Beckles. And then obviously in some of your statements, it's clear that he had a tremendous effect on you. So speak to us about that.
Yes. Thank you, Colin. So Professor Sir Hilary Beckles is the Vice Chancellor, as you were saying, of the University of the West Indies. He's also the Chair of CARICOM's Reparations Commission. So the 10-point plan that we were talking about, the Caribbean's 10-point plan for reparations over slavery, which begins with an apology and then calls for investment in health and education and debt forgiveness by the former colonial powers to the Caribbean islands. So when I was reporting this BBC documentary 2 years ago called Grenada, Confronting the Past, which was I used my ancestors' history of enslavement in Grenada, or history as enslavers, as a way into what the debate was in Grenada about reparations for slavery in the post-George Floyd era. And through that, I met Sir Hilary, and he's written several brilliant books. One of them's called Britain's Black Debt, which, if no one's ever read it, I would recommend it. It's the debt, Sir Hilary argues, that Britain owes the Caribbean because of slavery, because of the exploitation, because of the legacies of poverty, of illiteracy, of underdevelopment, the idea that all of the wealth left the Caribbean and went to Britain. And so at emancipation, the formerly enslaved were left with nothing, and in fact had just very badly paid jobs and terrible conditions for really for many years, until the Caribbean's independence movement in the 70s. So Hilary was a very influential figure with me. And then when our family wanted to try to draft a letter of apology to the people of Grenada for what our ancestors had done, Hilary really encouraged us. He worked with us, and he actually Zoomed with our family. These are people in Britain who've never been to the Caribbean, people who are doctors, educators, civil servants, you know, people who are worldly and, but not people who know really anything about the Caribbean or the way that people have been forced to live. And Hillary explained to us on this Zoom, because someone, an elderly cousin, said, why would an apology matter? And Hillary said, you don't understand that in the Caribbean, we don't know who our ancestors are. We just know they were kidnapped from Africa and dumped in the Caribbean. You know who you are. You can trace your history, you Trevelyans, back to the 10th century. But there's a pain in the Caribbean in not knowing who your ancestors are. And if you come forward and apologize, it will, you're part of our history too. It will have meaning to people, which really impressed our family members who hadn't really thought deeply about this. And he also told a story of growing up in Barbados and going to school with sugar in his lunchbox as a way of explaining how the epidemic of obesity, hypertension and diabetes across the Caribbean, which is something we see, of course, in African American communities to some degree too, how that is linked to being forced to eat sugar because that was all there was to eat on the plantations. So that this is a historic legacy of bad diet leading to bad health today. Again, that was something that family in England really had no idea about. I'd learned about it when I went to Grenada. So Sir Hillary's been really a very influential figure, and he helped me when I was thinking about leaving the BBC to, as I put it, to join the Caribbean's fight for reparatory justice. And Hillary said, well, look, Laura, you're a communicator. You can think of yourself as a bridge between the Caribbean and Britain. You might live in New York, but you have a foot in Britain. So you can help to explain things. And Milton, you were asking about whether things have changed. So the recent polling done by the Repair Campaign, sorry that I didn't finish my point, showed that more than half of people in Britain think an apology is appropriate for slavery, either by the government or the king, by the institutions involved with it. And also 4 out of 10 people think the Caribbean should get reparations, which as a baseline, I think 4 out of 10 isn't bad, actually.
All right. So at this point,
that's probably better than here.
I think it probably is.
Yeah, I thought. Oh, no, I just wanted to remind listeners, WBI is your favorite station because you support it, it's listener supported. So I just want to take a second here to remind you to support WBAI with your pledges. Please do call 212-209-2950. Any support, any pledge you make will go towards supporting the type of interview that you're listening to today. And of course, as you know, you can also adopt any one of our programs, including, of course, Black Star News Show as a buddy. You can do that by going to give and then number 2, WBI.org, in which case any amount that you designate will be taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. So back to our show. I have a question. You mentioned something interesting. One of the issues is that people in Britain really don't know how people in the Caribbean live. And we can say, for that matter, not know how people in Africa live as well. And we can say the same might apply to how European Americans don't really know how African Americans live or don't make that connection between slavery and the contemporary conditions. So we call in myself, we are always preaching to the choir, sort of. Mm-hmm. So obviously, we see much more value in a person like you, as Colin was suggesting, preaching to fellow Europeans, whether in Europe or here in the United States. What's been some of the reaction when you speak at public events? Have you spoken on college campuses? Obviously, you've been doing interviews. And in addition to responding to that side, I also would like you to address if this is the case, if you've also been accused of being a sellout, sort of. Why are you talking about this issue of reparations? Now you're opening Pandora's box. You're even talking about taxation for reparations.
Yes. I mean,
can't you just keep quiet?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I don't like to really look at my Twitter notifications because, you know, they tend to be full of people saying, you know, why don't you just shut up? And what about the Barbary pirates? I don't know if that reference means anything to you, but very few people in the west coast of England were kidnapped by the Barbary pirates who then you know, took away their liberty, but they were not enslaved in the way that Africans were enslaved. Their children did not become slaves. And also there were very few people taken by the Barbary pirates. So it's really not the same. But I guess in Britain, we call it whataboutism. And maybe you do here in America. So there's an awful lot of whataboutism. Well, what about the Romans? What about the Barbary pirates? What about, you know, so there's that. So, yeah, there's a sort of knee-jerk, what you might describe as a culture wars. You know, Britain is best known for abolishing slavery, and this is one of our finest achievements. What are you doing saying we should be paying reparations? But I always say to that that there's a selective amnesia in Britain, and I think here in the United States as well. So for Britain, when I was at school growing up, we were just taught about someone called William Wilberforce, who was one of the abolitionists in Britain. So we were just taught slavery was a terrible thing, but this amazing chap called William Wilberforce abolished it. And that was Britain's, you know, a fine hour. And then once the slave trade was abolished, Britain's Navy policed the abolition of the slave trade. And then soon after that, we abolished slavery. There's no telling of the impact of slavery, of why it was in Britain's economic interests, of the exploitation. It's just really told from that perspective of glorifying abolition and abolitionists. And actually, my great-grandfather, George Macaulay Trevelyan, was the best-selling historian of the first half of the 20th century. And in his English social history, he also glorifies abolition as being one of the most important achievements of 19th-century liberal Britain in his telling. And yet, he doesn't, of course, mention anywhere that he's also a descendant of enslavers. And I'm sure that he would have known because he was that much closer to it than I am. I only found out in 2016 when University College London put online the database of compensation paid to Britain's slave owners. That was when I found out. But George Macaulay Trevelyan must have known because he was writing in the 50s, which was so much closer to the period of slavery. So I guess I'm just trying to say there's a selective amnesia in Britain. And in America, it's obviously not the same as the Caribbean. The Caribbean is so far from Britain, people can ignore it. And the Windrush generation who came to work in Britain from the Caribbean in the 50s, because there were no opportunities in the Caribbean, because Britain needed a workforce in the post-World War II era, there's no actual link really even in Britain between the Windrush generation and slavery. It's very poorly understood that that's why people came, that in itself is a legacy of slavery. And then there was a dreadful scandal in the early 2000s when people from the Windrush generation who didn't have the right documents were caught up in an immigration crackdown and some were deported. So, again, poorly understood why people were there, why they didn't have documentation all these years later, and a disgraceful treatment of members of the Windrush generation. I think in the United States, it's very different because of the proximity, because, you know, especially in New York City, you know, you get the subway. We live cheek by jowl. I know that isn't the same in other areas of America where it's much more segregated and you can choose to ignore how people are living in, say, downtown Miami and Liberty City compared to how they're living in Key Biscayne. The two worlds don't meet. So I guess people can close their eyes and ignore what's happening. But you mentioned the Buffalo massacre at the beginning of the show. Well, that was someone who was racist, who went out deliberately to kill people based on the color of their skin, which is horrific. The same thing, one can argue, happened at the AME church in Charleston in South Carolina. This has happened too many times, but that's just a horrific example of racism. It's more to me, it's the week by week, day by day, hour by hour, legacies of poverty, of ill health, of lack of educational opportunity, of poverty that seems to be really ingrained generation from generation, and how to help people break out of that and to have the same opportunities. And that's why I think the Evanston, Illinois initiative, the direct payments to people who, you know, were affected by redlining, that seems like a really good way to go. I don't know what you two think about that.
Right. Obviously, there's going to have to be a combination of many things, and education has to play a big role in it. We can't just teach that these were some of the prominent abolitionists without noting that at that time, slavery had actually become an impediment toward the development of capitalism. So it was self-serving interests involved as well. But why don't we take a midpoint break, and then when we come back, let's talk a little bit about education and the role that should play in changing the public perception and attitudes towards some of the solutions going forward. Engineer Wee, the floor is all yours. If you have some music to lighten the mood a little. Listeners, welcome to the second half hour of Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM New York Radio. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi, joined as always by my comrade and friend, Colin Benjamin. Colin.
Yes.
I want
LKJ,
you to
lead I'm us still on the, I'm still on the second half hour. Yeah, I'm still on a little LKJ thing there.
Oh, you're still lost in the music.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, LKJ, yes.
Okay, but before we get started, because I know the second half hour always goes very, very quickly. So listeners, we can continue bringing you these types of discussion with your support. This is 100% listener supported station, the only one of its type in New York City. So we remind you to please be generous, pick up the phone, dial 212-209-2950. Any pledge, any support will go towards supporting all our programs. And you can also adopt any one of our shows as a buddy. And you can do that by going to give and the number 2, WBAI.org, in which case any amount that you designate will be taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. Colin, the floor is yours.
So, Ms. Trevelyan, you wrote an article in The Guardian last year. And one of the things that caught my attention was there was a part in there that you mentioned Britain's Industrial Revolution and it being fueled by slavery. And one of the reasons that it caught my attention, going back a couple decades, I got into a little bit of trouble with this Scottish professor who was speaking about the Industrial Revolution. And he didn't have any intention of mentioning the connection with slavery before I pressed him on it. And I got into a little bit of trouble. But the question here is, though, I'm wondering, besides pressuring Parliament, English and English lawmakers, I'm wondering about any initiatives that specifically targets the industrial sector in the UK in terms of reparations?
Well, there isn't anything specific that I'm aware of, but there as a strategy, but there are individual companies, like for example, the brewer Green King. So it's not exactly the Industrial Revolution. That's more, I guess, you know, the development of a society that enjoyed alcohol. And so Green King, they are to this day a major beverage company in Britain, but they have a link to plantations in the Caribbean, a historic link. And Greene King said in the wake of George Floyd's murder, you know, when companies all over, not just the US, but Europe, were pledging to do better in terms of whether it was black representation or trying to look at the legacies of slavery. So Greene King did pledge to do something, and an enterprising reporter at the Daily Telegraph has just followed up with him to find out what they've done. And the answer is that they say they're thinking about what they're going to do. The Church of England also, again, not exactly involved in the Industrial Revolution per se, but what would happen is when wealthy planters died, in some cases, they would leave their plantations to the Church of England if they didn't have any direct descendants. So the church became involved in slavery through that way. The Church of England has set up a £100 million fund to address the legacies of slavery, both in the Caribbean and Britain. It's not clear what that fund is going to do. Their working advisory group just issued their first report. But I do think there is a, you know, an understanding that profits from the period of slavery, that you can make a link between the past and the present. And even the King of England has said that he's deepening his understanding of slavery. And of course, the Royal African Company at the very beginning of slavery in the 17th century was sanctioned by the royal family, as the name suggests. And it was the Royal African Company that bought the enslaved from Africa to the Caribbean and British America in the early days of slavery. So clearly there's a link to the royal family's vast wealth today and slavery at the beginning. The question is, what do you do about all of this, and what is the right way to address it?
Let me also ask this. So you're a co-founder of Heroes of Slavery, right? And you
yes.
spoke a little bit about that. And you spoke a little bit about having some contact with people in other European countries. Can you speak a little bit more about that? Are there other groups, for example, in other places in Europe that we should know about, that you're either in contact with or that, you know, you're aware of, that are doing similar things like your group?
Right. I'd like to build on that same question too. Can you point some countries or some locations where an organization similar to yours has had significant impact in changing the public perception, and actually point to some concrete change that they can claim was as a result of part of the work?
I wish that I could, Milton, but in answer to your question and to Collins, I would say that individuals are beginning to come forward. And just to give you an example, I'm in touch with some people in New Zealand. I mean, who knew that plantation owners in the British Caribbean, when slavery was abolished and they got their compensation money, quite a few of them went to Australia and New Zealand to settle new colonial lands. Those were then part of the British Empire. I think this story is very little understood in New Zealand and Australia. And I hope that later this summer, that at an event in the Caribbean, that this link to that part of the world will become apparent. And I hope that that will prompt a debate. In Portugal, for example, there's a Reuters journalist called Catarina Demini who reached out to me. She's just made a documentary in Portuguese about the Portuguese were the biggest slave traders of all, as you will know, to Brazil. Angola to Brazil was the slave route. Catarina made a documentary about her ancestors' involvement in that trade, and she called it Under the Rug, because there's no debate in Portugal at all about this, you know, in part because the country was a military dictatorship. But then just 2 weeks ago, Portugal's president said, you know, it's time not just to apologize for slavery, but to think about how we repay the cost, is how he put it. He was then immediately jumped on by Portugal's center-right government, who said there's no question of reparations. But this is the first time that anyone in Portugal has ever said anything like this, this idea of paying the cost. So that I take to be important. I haven't heard about anything in Spain, but I have also had people in France reach out to me. Our family was invited to Nantes, which was, it's a port on the Atlantic coast of France that was heavily involved in the slave trade. We were invited by an heir of people who were involved in the shipping trade, in the triangular trade in Nantes, and also by descendants of the enslaved from Martinique who now live in France. Well, Martinique is part of France. And they want to get a debate going in France and in the French Caribbean because, as you'll know, Martinique, Guadeloupe, they're still part of France. They're departements of France. So there's really no debate there. There's no equivalent to the Caribbean's 10-point plan because these islands are part of France. And yet there are legacies of slavery there. The Beke, as they're known, the direct descendants of the planters, are still in powerful economic positions even now. So I wish I could point to things that were more concrete. I guess what I'm really pointing to is the raising of awareness and the beginnings of debate in these countries, which, by the way, are way behind America because of the structure of slavery.
Yeah, I mean, things are definitely changing. I mean, I remember about 15 years ago, a European-American elected official here in New York City, you know, asked me, he said, Milton, I hear all this talk about reparations. I want to ask you frankly, are Black people really serious about this? This, doesn't it sound a bit insane to you? That was just 15 years ago. I don't think any elected European-American official would put it in that context today. I mean, there's still many, of course, who think it's insane. I don't think they'll say it publicly, unless, you know, the far right, of course. But certainly, very few prominent Democratic elected officials in New York City would actually ask a reporter a question like that. So I want to ask you about, you know, the importance of these alliances and having advocates like you involved in the discussions about reparations, especially when we are talking at a time when wealth is being concentrated within a very small, very wealthy minority part of the population in the United States, in Europe. So it might even make these type of discussions much more challenging. You know, what are you talking about, reparations? Everybody's having such a hard time when wealth is being concentrated among small elite. I had somebody I know who's actually very wealthy, and I've told this story before on this show. He is a billionaire. And he once confided to me out of the blue, unsolicited. He said, Milton, I believe there's going to be a revolution in the United States. And I say, why do you say this? He said, because when I started making my money in the 1980s, there used to be a middle class in this country. You could actually get a decent job, pay off your home, send your kids to school, retire, have money in the bank, go on vacation. Now it's impossible. Now you need three jobs just to survive. Because today there's only me and everybody else, and you cannot sustain a society like that. They think they can use the police or the military to suppress it, but it's not going to work. So when we have a very wealthy person speaking like this, and obviously we're still introducing this very just reparation that needs to be done, how do you see these dynamics interacting? And that's why I started off by saying we need more advocates like you to be involved in this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you raise such a good question. And of course, we're here in New York City where these disparities of wealth are so enormous, yes, aren't they? And, you know, I hear my children, who two of whom have graduated from college, one who's about to go, but it's interesting how they are talking about moving out of New York, going to parts of the country that are more affordable, going to the South, to the Southwest, because life in New York is just crazily expensive, to your point, if you're going to be in the middle class. But I mean, in terms of what could be done that would be concrete and would have public support, because that's the key, really. I guess that's what attracted me to the Caribbean's 10-point plan for reparations over slavery, is it's an extremely reasonable demand for these islands, which, by the way, at independence from Britain, they were left with absolutely nothing. There was nothing in their bank account at all.
Absolutely.
The British colonial office made absolutely sure of that. So it's almost like a double whammy of, well, triple whammy, not just slavery, the compensation going to the slave owners, but then independence and being really left with nothing, which, by the way, I think is why the French Caribbean doesn't want to be independent, because they see what happens. And by the way, look at Haiti, which we haven't even talked about, where the French made Haiti pay for its independence.
Yes.
A ruinous financial legacy for Haiti, which you can see today. But just to back up a bit, in terms of, you know, what could happen here in America that would garner public support, because, you know, we live in a democracy, we have to persuade people. You're talking about public money here. The way that Evanston has done it with money for descendants of those or people who were affected by redlining, that, you know, the world hasn't fallen in and that's happened. So you start small. I saw that in Harlem, one of the schools there, independently funded academies, I think, is talking about giving their students money when they graduate from high school that's then kept in a fund for them. And when they graduate from college, they may have about $25,000.
Right. There's actually an economist who's advocating for that as a national program as well.
Well, but that seems to me, I think if we talk about investing in our youth and in their future, I think that it's easy to get public or easier to get public support for that. Because everybody loves children. Everybody wants a better future for our youth. You know, those of us who are middle-aged, well, we've formed habits. We're either on the property ladder or we're not. But just the idea that people coming out of college, which is when typically you might try to get on the property ladder if you possibly could, just this idea of that seed fund. And maybe it's even some, I mean, you can't, I don't think in America you'll ever get support for direct cash payments to individuals, unless it's along the Evanston lines where it's very specific. But could we not, if we look at, say, Harlem, could we not say that people who are living in certain zip codes of Harlem, and by the way, at this point, this may incorporate those who are Hispanic, who are extremely poor also, but can we not do something by zip code where we say there should be a baby bond for every child born in this zip code. And by the time they graduate from college, we hope that this will be worth $25,000 or the equivalent when they graduate. Just money that you can use to get on the property ladder, you can use for further education. Maybe you get it at 18, you use it for the cost of college. Just something like that.
Right. Since a lot of the redlining will zip code anyway.
Yeah, is in those areas. Yeah. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I like that idea. You know, I mean, like Milton said earlier, you know, we have to look at any number of different things depending on where you are. Recently, I've heard about the homelessness in California, but recently I saw some videos that some regular people made, and I was horrified because although I've been hearing about this homeless situation in, you know, in these black areas, and I hadn't realized it was that bad, seeing all of the tents and, you know, in certain neighborhoods too. Like there was one video where outside this guy's house, it was so much trash and a lot of people's personal belongings and all of that type of stuff. But, you know, and there was a video too in Oakland, just like horrendous. But let me ask another question here. Maybe it's an unfair question, so let me say I'll just ask your thoughts on this. You know, earlier you spoke a bit about the difference between the reparations groups in the UK and here, and I'm wondering about the reparations movement in the UK, in the US, and in the Caribbean. And I'm wondering, in terms of a working relationship between those different groups, I'm wondering, you know, what you see. Do you see you know, good unity, solidarity there? Or do you think, you know, it needs to be better than what it is?
It's a great question. And yes, I think it's definitely a work in progress, isn't it? Because the Caribbean has its reparations plan, its 10-point plan, which has come from governments. In Britain, for example, the reparations movement historically, the MP Bernie Grant, for example, the Tottenham MP, was extremely prominent in the reparations movement in Britain. So growing up, I would have thought of Bernie Grant as being someone, you know, who was quite left-wing, who an important figure, but not necessarily somebody with really broad support. Now, Bernie Grant, sadly, is no longer with us, but I find myself on the same side of the argument now as Bernie Grant. But I would say the left sort of black reparations movement in Britain sees the Caribbean's reparations movement as being middle class, as dominated by governments, not as not being driven by civil society. So there are definitely differences there. And then, of course, here in the US, this being the US, there are just so many different groups that, and I haven't, it's nice to talk to both of you. And it was very nice to be invited by Stephen Golding to go to hear him deliver the inaugural Marcus Garvey New York lecture in Harlem the other day. Because right. These are really the first sort of times that I've been invited to be involved in the debate in America. So I'm looking forward to learning more about it. But so I can talk with a bit more knowledge about the dynamics between the Caribbean and Britain than I can really here in the US. But I would just say that Professor Sir Hilary Beckles, who, as you noted, is like a guru to me. But when Hilary was here in New York in September and the president of Ghana was here, and, you know, the African Union is now backing the Caribbean's reparations call finally after years of division. And indeed, the African Union has said that it too would like reparations, although in what form we don't know. So there's finally some unity there, which is important. But Hilary said, I heard him give a speech in September, and he said the reparatory justice movement will be the greatest movement of the 21st century because it's about love and justice and it's about healing. And I think that that's true. And I think that that framing is very powerful, especially as we have, you know, citizens in all of our country, our citizenship is becoming more diverse and more representative, more non-white, essentially. So I think that drives a different discussion.
Laura Trevelyan, co-founder of Heirs of Slavery, thank you for joining us today. We've run out of time, unfortunately. There are many other questions we have for you, and we will definitely have you back for part two, because we'd also like you to speak at some point about how involvement in the reparations discussion has transformed you as a person. But let's save that for next time. Tell listeners how they can get in touch with your organization, and then we'll have to sign off.
Colin and Milton, thank you so much for having me. And yes, you can just go to the Heirs of Slavery website, and you can always reach me via LinkedIn. And I'd love to hear from all of you. And thank you for this honor and privilege.
Thank you so much, everybody. Remain Pan-African and see you next week. Wuyi, the floor is yours. You can close out for us. Thanks, Claudia.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
FM, WBAI, New York.
I'm grateful to have WBAI. You know, it's not easy in this country. It's very rare, actually, in this country to find platforms, specifically media platforms, where we can say what we want and how we want it. This is a necessary platform. And if we want to continue to archive the voices of Palestinian Americans and pro-Palestinian voices, we got to pay for it, because freedom is not free in America. They told you it was, but it's not. And so being able to be part of the movement to put our money where our mouth is, if we want freedom of speech, we got to invest in that, unfortunately. And fortunately, you get to do that at WBAI with a team of incredible people, some people who've been at WBAI for decades, continuing to maintain this platform so that new generations like mine can access this space. So go to WBAI.org. Give what you can, my friends. What you have is all we need. So we're not asking for millions here. We are asking for grassroots support, $10, $20, $5, $500 if you have it. If you have $1,000, we'll take that too.
Let's keep it going. WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York. Go to towerfund.wbai.org and contribute. Do what you can. Or call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Do your part to help keep us on the air.
The next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting will be on Sunday, May 19th, 2024, at 1 p.m. The call-in number is 619-309-1058. The PIN number is 641711. Everyone is welcome to call in and join the meeting. Again, the call-in number is 619-309-1058. The PIN number is 641711. Hope to see you at the meeting.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Israeli forces pushed further into the southern Gaza city of Rafah today, reaching some residential areas in the city where over a million Palestinians are sheltering. Witnesses reported explosions in eastern portions of the city. Hamas said it killed some Israeli soldiers when it bombarded a troop carrier today. A spokesperson for the UN Secretary General said that in Gaza, quote, nowhere is safe now, and reiterated his call for an immediate ceasefire. A UN agency says nearly 500,000 people have fled Rafah since last week. Fighting has also intensified in northern Gaza, including in the large Jabalia refugee camp built for Palestinians displaced by Israel's founding 76 years ago. Much of Gaza's population is on the brink of famine, and the medical facilities that do remain are running short of fuel and other supplies.